Well, howdy. This is Keith Ulick subbing for John Lichtman and Lichtman and Rizzo live at Grassroots Tavern. This is sort of an addendum podcast.
Maybe it'll be its own.
Maybe a different one. Who knows? I'm here with John's cohort, the wonderful, lovely Vadim Rizzo.
Hello.
Hello. And our guests from the Can podcast are here still, Glenn Kenny and Karina Longworth.
That's me.
Hey, baby.
Hey, hey. So, this part of the podcast, we're going into, I believe, a Roman Polanski documentary, is it?
Yeah.
That you all wanted to talk about, because I believe you and Karina both have differing opinions on
it,
correct?
Well, we were supposed to do a podcast about this at Sundance, and that didn't happen.
Because of equipment limitations that we were unaware of.
Right, okay. And then I told my friend AJ Schnock, the documentary filmmaker and blogger, that I had, you know, been supposed to do this podcast. He was really excited about, like, having the two of us argue about the film. So tonight, right before I came out here, I was talking to him, and I was like, I'm going to go do a podcast with such and such and such and such, like Glenn Kenny. He was like, oh, you have to talk to Glenn about the Roman Polanski film. So right now is the time.
Okay.
He's right that it is the time, because it's about
extra special bonus podcast about Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, which will never come out, but we're still alive.
It'll come out. It's been bought by HBO Films.
It's coming out on HBO, like, next week.
Right.
Didn't IFC buy it for a...
Think Film bought it, but Think Film is, like, dead.
So probably by the time everybody hears this, it'll have premiered or whatever, but, you know, we can talk about it.
Well, then we... Yeah, or the 181st Street release.
I can start with, like, my take on the film.
Ladies first?
And then you can argue with me.
Go for it.
I thought that there were some great things about it. I really loved...
And I'm sorry, just to interrupt, the name of the film again is...
Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, and I don't remember the name of the filmmaker.
Okay, fine.
I'll look it up.
Okay, right. But go on, Karina, please.
There are certain things about the film that I like a lot. I really love the director's use of clips from Polanski films to provide sort of like an ironic context for things. I mean, it's really great that she got the victim of Polanski's rape to speak on camera extensively. However, I think that ultimately the film takes not just a sympathetic view on the rape itself, but it takes almost an anti-American view, where it's like, well, in France, this wouldn't have been a big deal at all, because people fuck 13-year-olds in France all the time.
Right.
And it basically makes it seem like America is unenlightened compared to France. And that just felt a little creepy to me.
Okay. Glenn?
Well, I think the problem that a lot of people have with the film is in terms of its emphasis. And I think that you could argue that to a large extent it is fairly sympathetic to Polanski, but what I found interesting in terms of the reaction of the film is the idea that, you know, for some reason people still feel a need to judge Polanski on this. And to bring this up is not to to try and excuse the deplorable crime that Polanski did in fact commit. He did commit a deplorable crime. He basically drugged a 13-year-old and had sex with her.
With Quaaludes, correct?
Pardon me?
Quaaludes, right?
Half a Quaalude, but you know... If you, you know, back in the 70s, half a Quaalude is almost as good as whatever. I mean, again, I don't mean that's making light of it. It was a fucking completely heinous act that he did, and yeah, the film does try to soft soap the act a little bit more than I think.
It basically puts the blame on the judge that convicted him.
Right, but by the same token. And here's where I thought the film was effective. The blame, I gotta disagree with you that it puts the blame on the judge. I mean, here's the thing. Polanski, after having committed this admittedly heinous crime, he did walk the walk. He was, by the standards of American justice, the American judicial system, he was what you might even call a model defendant. He submitted himself to 90 days imprisonment and psychiatric evaluation. He did everything that was expected of him. And this is the thing about the film that makes the film sort of an interestingly compelling case, not in terms of exonerating Polanski in terms of his heinous acts, but in terms of talking about how the system of American justice was abused by this particular judge, Rittenbrand, to the extent that even the prosecuting attorney, a rather moralistic and very straight-arrow Mormon, comes out and says, no, this, you know, yeah, I think that Polanski should have been sent up the river for this, but if he was going to be sent up the river, he should have been sent up the river initially and in a more proper way. What the film chronicles is how the judge, Rittenbrand, after, you know, Polanski had been an exemplary defendant and had, you know, basically gotten a result from the American justice system that was a logical result given everything that he submitted himself to and everything that his defense lawyer and the prosecution did. In other words, the wishes of the prosecution, the wishes of the victim's family, all said one thing, and then the judge, because his friends at the country club said, are you going to let this commie pole pervert dwarf walk, then suddenly decided, oh no, you know what, I'm going to renege on every agreement that we made. So what the film does is that it sort of separates our own tendency to judge Polanski and goes into a procedural of how American justice was perverted by the whim of a judge. I don't think it...
No, I think that's true, but I'm actually curious. The whole reason why, like, I thought about talking about this to you was because at Sundance, Brian Stewart was very insistent that, like, you had a problem with the review that I wrote.
Oh, well, then, see, this is, again, no.
There was also there was an interesting thing where Tom Carson and GQ was running about how he thought the movie displayed and didn't exploit fully the idea. His, Tom Carson's idea is that in the 70s, morality completely went down the tubes.
Right. Well,
the documentary takes that unquestioned. It's the 70s.
I think that the film does have an element of that. Like Polanski was a product not just of the 70s, but like he was obviously mentally fucked up from having escaped the Holocaust.
Carson also,
I think that the film like finds a million excuses to explain why Polanski didn't get it. You know, the 70s. He's European.
The 70s, and also Carson says, Polanski
is very interesting.
Tough-minded, and he can't accept normal human relations.
Well, yes and no, but there's an interesting thread. There's an interesting thread on Richard Brody's new biography of Godard.
Which I just started reading.
Yeah, well, we should talk when we get to the point of Godard making France Tour de Tour des Enfants and Daniel Cohn-Bendit.
I've seen half of that, and I hated every minute of it.
Right, yeah. But the exploration of children's sexuality that was acceptable in the 70s, that it becomes totally taboo 20 years later.
Or the idea,
again, we're not making excuses for it, but there are differences in the zeitgeist and differences in certain radical or progressive modes of thought as they are articulated at different times. Again, not to excuse what Polanski did. And I don't think there's any excuse for what Polanski did.
Well, I think what Polanski did actually transgressed the bounds of any, like, decade. Like, but it's still not the kind of thing where you keep a dude out of the country for 30 years.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when you talk to people who have kids, I was talking to a friend of mine who's, you know, a person in the film world who's a... And he was looking at me when I was defending the film like I was, like, out of my fucking mind. It's like, well, wait a minute. He raped a 13-year-old. I said, yes, he did. But the film is not about that. And maybe that is the flaw of the film. But by the same token, there's this other thing where, yeah, Polanski committed a heinous crime. But in certain people's minds, he's made to be a stand-in for everyone who's committed that crime. When I saw the film at Sundance, and I don't know if you were at that screening, Karina.
When I saw the film at Sundance,
the first question from the audience when the director came up was like, well, what would you sentence Polanski to? And what is fascinating to me is that the idea of that over 30 years after the fact, that people are still thinking in terms of, like, has Polanski been punished enough?
Right.
And that's an interesting phenomenon in and of itself.
And I have to say, I mean, for me, it was I mean, I do wonder why Ryan thought that you and I should argue about it, and like if you had like actually even read my review, or if he was making it up.
No, but I had read your review, but I honestly don't remember. What I think I said to Ryan was that your perspective, I didn't object. No, I will categorically say I did not object to your review. That I thought your review represented a perspective that would be interesting to debate.
Yeah.
Different thing. I did not object to your review.
Well,
but I was interested in where the review was coming from. I wish we had talked about it then, because then we would be clearer on it.
It's not really fresh in our minds right now, so yeah. I feel like it's a shitty
It was January, for God's sake.
I feel like I'm wasting your guys' time. I'm sorry.
Why? You're not. Not at all. No one wastes
No, it's a movie worth talking about, and her perspective is worth talking about, because, I mean, I don't think it soft soaps it. They have those excerpts from the Clive James interview where they're sitting there eating escargot like a couple of sophisticated continental men, and James is able to sort of like coddle him into saying, "Oh well, yes, I do like the young women." I mean, and it is creepy.
It's creepy. But I think that ultimately she ameliorates it and is like, you know what? He's been through so much. He's been through the Holocaust. His wife got brutally murdered. He's European. Like, maybe it was okay for him to act out all of his trauma by fucking a 13-year-old girl after giving her a quaalude and then putting it in her ass.
Well, if that's what the film is saying, I certainly don't agree with it.
That's what I read the film as saying.
Yeah. Well, let's take that into...
Especially because, I mean, basically the last thing that happens in the film is that the filmmaker justifies the title. She's like, she's like, well, you know, in America, he's wanted. He's a criminal. He's wanted as a criminal. But in Europe, he's desire.
No, I see what you're saying, and I agree with you. It does definitely play up the idea of us puritanical Americans who just don't get it.
Right. And, I mean, that's really what pisses me off.
Well, let's take this into a discussion of a recent film, Sex and the City.
As I was saying, I'm really fucking tired of talking about Sex and the City, but Glenn has something new to say about it. I'd like to hear it.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen the film yet, and...
I haven't either.
In the arguments that I've had about it online and in person, it seems that any kind of argument against it is sort of automatically tainted with sexism or snobbery or some such
or
thing.
Or some like perception of that.
Sex in the City.
More the perception than actuality. I mean, I feel like people are calling these reviews a bit misogynist, but really they just don't like it that people are saying that the movie is bad.
Yeah, okay. Well, there was that caricature of the four main characters in The New Yorker.
Is the only misogynist thing that's really been produced.
Yeah, then again, it's in The New Yorker, and it's been pretty widely disseminated. I mean, I don't like the idea of being cast into this mass of male critics who is de facto against the, you know, female-centric romantic comedy. I mean, I could get with about 75% of The Devil Wears Prada. I thought, in a lot of respects, you know, when it strayed outside of standard Hollywood conventions, which I've learned to accept just by, you know, Pavlovian training, it was a pretty fresh and witty comedy, you know? So, you know, the idea that one can only, you know, there's this whole, what I find fascinating about the reactions to Sex and the City is the lengths to which its defenders will stretch to make a defense of it. My favorite is Catherine Jean Lopez in the National Review, who's like a complete sort of maniacal Roman Catholic abstinence only crusader.
Wow.
Who says that the film is actually really good because in the final analysis, after, you know, what?
Because these women give up being sluts.
Right. Eight or nine seasons of completely, you know, of complete spilling of bodily fluids, they finally decide, well, we really want love and marriage and children.
And that's exactly why I hate it.
Right. And it's that's the formula for every Hollywood romantic comedy since the Ross Hunter days of Doris Day and and Rock
honestly,
Hudson.
Like, I've been trying to figure out exactly what it is about this whole phenomenon that pisses me off. And then this weekend I moved into a new apartment, and I just kind of left the television on while I was moving, like unpacking stuff. And it turns out that like TBS or TNT or one of those channels like likes to play Pretty Woman over and over and over again. And Pretty Woman, like, I mean, the big thing that, like, intelligent women say about Sex and the City is, like, well, it's junk food. Why can't you let us have our junk food? For me, Pretty Woman is junk food. And I honestly think that Pretty Woman is more intelligent junk food than Sex and the City. I mean, ultimately, it's basically a screwball comedy that, like, sort of deals with class issues a little bit with the prostitution thing. But really, it's like a Howard Hawks movie.
And you have heard the story about Pretty Woman and when Gary Marshall stepped onto it, right?
No.
Right, the original script was called 3000.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was a gritty drama.
It was a gritty drama starring.
There are kind of messages in it. I mean, like, the first scene in the movie is, like Julia Roberts, like, climbing out of her hotel window on the fire escape because she can't pay her rent, and then finding out that her friend, another hooker, has been beaten to death by her pimp and is, like, found dead in a dumpster. And they spend a long time on that scene.
A gritty drama starring Jennifer Jason Leigh, originally. Then Gary Marshall comes on, and Jennifer Jason Leigh asks, you know, what are you going to make it into or whatever? And then, Gary Marshall starts justifying, you know, all these things, and she's disagreeing. And then he's like, well, she's only been doing it for a few weeks. It's still fun for her.
Right. Well, that's a weird thing about the movie is, like, you know, the whole...
No, but ultimately, I think in the end, like, I mean, in the actual film, like, it's not fun for her.
Yeah, you can't watch...
So even Gary Marshall can't fuck that up.
Yeah, you can't watch Pretty Woman and ever look at Jason Alexander the same way again. You know?
Yeah,
it ruined... The thing about Pretty Woman is that it ruined Seinfeld for you, essentially.
Huh, wow.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that Pretty Woman is... a much more interesting film than a lot of people give it credit for.
And more so than Sex and the City is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Certainly as a romantic comedy and certainly as a fairy tale film.
Yeah, very much a fairy tale film.
Okay.
I mean, it explicitly references the fairy tale.
Yeah, no, the main female character is like, I want the fairy tale.
Yeah.
And then Richard Gere's like, fuck it, I'll give it to you.
Okay.
It's weird.
It is a weird film.
And how does,
much weirder than people give it credit for, I think.
And how does all this connect back to the Roman Polanski documentary?
It doesn't. It connects back to, like while every other woman in America this weekend was going to see Sex and the City, on Saturday I stayed home and I watched, you know, like, the Hillary hearings on MSNBC, and on Sunday I watched Pretty Woman twice while I was, like, unpacking
boxes. She might as well be
boxes.
Being
well, you
played
know,
by
Roman Polanski, in the aftermath, you know, his career after his exile has been pretty spotty in terms of film, but he made one of the
Oliver
most...
Oliver Twist!
He made one of the most pessimistic films about male-female relationships ever, which was Bitter Moon. Which actually is in a way, Bitter Moon ends up as a condemnation of the Hugh Grant and Kristin Scott Thomas couple for not having children. That's the ending of Bitter Moon is they've survived this crucible with Peter Coyote and Emmanuel Seigneur, and then they look on the deck and they see the Indian doctor with his kids and they say, oh, that's the cure for our lack of sexual chemistry and everything else of our malaise that ended up with the couple we've been hanging out with committing a murder-suicide. We just need to have kids. That aside,
it's kind of like Ian McEwan's The Comfort of Strangers.
Oh, boy. There's another one.
Boy, we're moving from Sex and the City to Pinter and Schrader, for God's sake.
Yeah, you know what?
We should probably just stop this podcast.
Because our personal lives don't involve violent murder as a solution to the perplex of heterosexual romantic love.
Glenn and Karina, any final words on this addendum podcast to our CAM podcast?
Well, the only thing I would like to say is that... we talked a little bit about how critics hated the James Gray film and how they hated the Carell film, but they're basically the same film.
Yeah. We love movies about passion. Because...
That's true.
Because, you know, Vadim is now, like...
Sorry.
Vadim is now glad that he spilled the beer
movies,
on me.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean, films about...
Spielberg movies, too.
Films
yeah,
about,
I cry every time.
You know,
well,
what great films in a sense, aren't about passion. From Tarkovsky to Hawks to...
I'm trying to count how many times I believe it, like, so viciously flicked me off during this evening.
Who did?
About 50 times.
Who flipped you off?
Vadim.
But it was mostly directed to him.
He flipped me off a lot, too, tonight. Sorry.
Our message is... Yes. Keep watching films.
Yeah, please.
Amen to that.
And don't let the rep scene die, because it's going to die in 10 years, so just take advantage of it, please.
Just go to film forum.
Ladies and gentlemen, this
is
been...
If you're in New York, see Vivre Sa Vie by Godard at film forum.
Go to the Hawks retrospective.
Go to the Hawks retrospective anthology.
Shout out to Jared Rockfogel.
Ladies and gentlemen.
The guy says at the end of The Thing, which was Ghost directed by Howard Hawks, keep watching the skies. Keep watching the screens.
As they say at the end of the X-Files episode of The Simpsons, keep watching the skis. I mean, skies.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Lichtman and Rizov. God knows what episode. Probably 13 or 14, somewhere around there. We'll figure it out. I don't even know if it has a name.
Sorry about this.
But our guests have been, probably for two or three episodes now, Glenn Kenny and Karina Longworth, who we absolutely love for having come out. And this is Keith Ulick, along with Vadim Rizov.
Thank you.
Saying good night.
My God, Vadim didn't say anything.
And we are going to go get steaming ass drunk now. Love y'all.